All right, I would like to call this committee of the whole meeting to order for January 9, 2018. May I get a roll call, please?
Mr. Davis.
Here.
Mrs. Deogracius.
Here.
Mrs. Hickey.
Here.
Mr. Martyri.
Yep.
Mr. Moore.
Here.
Dr. Thompson.
Here.
Ms. Williams.
Here.
All right, the first thing we always do is recognize visitors and invite comments from the public. Anthony, did anyone sign up?
No, our visitor did not sign to speak.
You know, we're going to have a couple of things that are really controversial that we would prefer come from you later, so I'll just hand you that memo and that'd be great. All right, I need a motion to approve the agenda.
Ms. Williams.
Yes.
Dr. Thompson.
Yes.
Mr. Moore.
Yes.
Mr. Martyri.
Yep.
Mrs. Hickey.
Yes.
Mrs. Deogracius.
Yes.
Mr. Davis.
Yes. All right, so that moves on to the first substantive part of today's convening. We're going to be going through our proposed D90 school calendar for the 2018-19 year. It's the first review.
Yes. Okay. So I'd like to thank Dr. Allison Hawley and the faculty and parent committee that were gracious enough to put their time into creating this draft of the proposed District 90 public school calendar for the forthcoming year. This is the first time the board's had the opportunity to see this. Of course, it'll come back for formal adoption if it's to the board's liking at the subsequent meeting. But a few highlights. It actually dovetails very well with the calendar that's in place for this year. A lot of overlap in terms of kind of how the days seem to fall, so to speak. The board will recall some unique elements here that we have, for the first time in advance, the ability to have layered in our additional staff institute day. And so that will be at the end of the school year, which is kind of a unique approach for us. We've not tried that before. Parent-teacher conferences fall roughly the same time as they have in the past. Student start date is fairly close to OPRF high school. One of the challenges there, that's just an element of the schedule that they're running, is the high school is now pretty dedicated consistently to having their first semester completed by winter break and the second semester afterwards. So that does force them to start a little bit earlier. But again, the start date of August 23rd puts us in good stead with both 297. The end date, including emergency days, is June 17th. It's been some time since, knock on wood, we've used many, if certainly not all, of our emergency days, so it's entirely possible that the children would be out 5 days earlier. The only thing that we don't love about the way the days fell this year is the fact that the final day for faculty will require them to return on a Monday in June for that last institute day, but we didn't have the ability to adjust the calendar as it fell in 2018-19, so we're kind of forced to live with the circumstances that we have.
Did we accommodate Yom Kippur?
Yes. So, again, my thanks to the faculty, staff, parents, and administrators who worked on this. We'd like the board, of course, to have time to take a look at it at their leisure, but we do feel very good about how it links up with 97 and 200, and really, I think, supports, most importantly, the teaching and learning that we want to do in the district next year. So.
Okay, the second item is the Safer Routes to School meeting that Anthony, Ed, and I held with River Forest Village officials. Real quick, they came to us and said that they were interested in doing a study to see if they could identify safer walking routes, et cetera, et cetera. We offered to co-sponsor the study, pay for it, and collaborate with them fully on it, and anticipate moving forward. Even though the amount of money to be expended on these consultants is a very small amount, and it would fall actually within your discretion as an expense, I still am going to ask the board to approve it just so that we have a public acknowledgement that our board is working collaboratively with the village. And I would say kudos to the village for bringing this to us. They brought it to us. And it was really a very decent proposal that they put on the table, and we were fully engaged in moving forward. Ed, do you want to add anything to that?
I think that says it all.
So if I could get at the next board meeting a motion to sort of approve on the agenda the expenditure and co-sponsoring this hiring of consultants to identify safer routes to school, and then we'll just move forward on that. So we'll do that at our next board meeting. And then, although it's not noted here, I am gonna say briefly that we have a celebrity among us. One Dr. Condon was identified by the Wednesday Journal as a villager of note for 2017-18, and he certainly deserves that. There will be a letter going out tomorrow, but I wanted to personally extend my congratulations to Ed on behalf of myself and the board. We've all been thrilled with your dedication to the school, your dedication to moving forward on very tough issues like equity and inclusivity, while still keeping your eyes focused on the prize, which is a highly rigorous education for all of our kids that meets all of their needs. So Ed, we appreciate your leadership. You deserve this honor, and I say kudos.
In fairness, the work that's happening in District 90 would not be happening were it not for the support and leadership of our board, the dedication of our administrative team, the commitment of our teachers, and the support of our families.
And I almost was going to say you were finally speechless.
So it does take all. Dr. Condon, very humble.
Thank you.
Did you get that, Anthony?
Yeah.
Excellent. All right, that moves us to the Facility Committee and Judy D. O'Grassi.
Thank you, Ralph. Well, I had the pleasure last night of having a village meeting with Dr. Condon and Rosie and Mr. Dahlquist, who's the project architect, and the village board unanimously approved, except, well, there was one person who was refused.
Judy, can you speak up? Sorry, it's hard to hear.
Oh, I'm sorry. One person was recused from voting because of his business relationship with the district. So anyway, they did vote in our favor to approve our, I'm not sure what the technical term is.
I would say the amendment to the plan development permit.
It doesn't really roll off my tongue. It rolls off yours. So we're in good shape, and here with us tonight.
Yes, with Anthony, yes.
I can do it. He'll answer questions.
Oh, okay.
Is it going up on there?
Yes, if you guys want to.
Yeah, I'm gonna.
I'm going to use the microphone here in case you can't hear me. Some of this is this is going to be new to you. For those of you who've seen this, there'll be a little bit of a repeat preview. There'll be several slides on here that talk about Willard's proposed project and the reasons why. There'll be some photographs that show a little bit of these space constraints and generally the reason on why this project is important. Only I will be speaking on behalf of this project unless you have questions that I can answer. So this is a rendering of what the project will look like when it's done, if the board approves it, when we take it to them next week. If you notice at the north end of the building, there's two stories. Right now, there's only one story. So you'll start to see some different elevations and floor plans about where this will take us after this project is completed. So if you don't know River Forest, Willard School is on Ashland, just north of Division, right there. So, what are space constraints? Some of them I'll talk about, and I'll try not to reference specific room numbers because you may not be familiar with the inside of the building. But I will tell you that whether or not this is considered a two-classroom addition or a three-classroom addition or multi-purpose rooms or small instructional spaces, there isn't anything to be added because we expect an increase in enrollment. It's to reconfigure the building to alleviate these areas that you're about to see visually. So one of the problems is the skills program is in a room, it's actually in two rooms, that is not optimal for their needs. There, you can see a big swing in the middle of one of these smaller rooms here, and they're using the what used to be the conference room as an area to put other types of small desks in, and that is right next door. So they have to leave the room, go into another room to utilize the other portions. STEM, which is very important to us in this district, is held in the library. So that impacts a lot of students that go through and participate in the STEM class, but also those that are participating in library activities in the other parts of that area. Inclusion preschool skills and special ed resources actually are in the first floor hallway. That's the what we call the west wing at the south end of the building. It impacts many students directly, but also even more indirectly because they're out in the hallway and it's a distraction to those classrooms in that wing. Our school psychologist is in the second floor elevator landing. And I just want to tell you, none of this is unsafe or violating any fire codes or life safety codes, but it isn't optimal. Obviously, there's no privacy here. Many students are directly impacted by this for the testing this provides and the other private nature and personal nature of some of the conversations either with students or with their families. Our special ed resource class is held in what used to be our LLC computer lab. As you can see, that is a very small area. We have to put privacy filters on the glass. And see, they've done wonderful with decorating the room, but not a lot of other space in there for education purposes. Our instructional technology specialist and our tech support is in the LLC entranceway. So that impacts many students as well, not only for those areas, but those entering the library. Our MTSS intervention aid is actually behind the first floor elevator that impacts many students. Even though I believe at Christmas she had some lights around the area. So
she painted
those
yellow spots to make it green.
She's also has an area on the second floor, but she has to share that with occupational therapy in a hallway. Many students are impacted by that as well. Our new assistant principal that's shared between Lincoln and Willard has his office in the conference room, the relocated conference room. So anytime there's a large meeting, he has to leave. Anytime he has something important to do, they can't have a meeting. Our instructional specialist is actually in a storage room. She's here today, and she doesn't, even though she's smiling, she's really not happy at all. Behind her is the pump for the sprinkler system, so I don't know if that makes a lot of noise or has any things that might intimidate her while she's sitting in there doing her work or talking to the students. And we have our special ed aides, or one special ed aide in a foyer where we don't have the ability for any storage in there, as well as having all of that interaction happening once again in the hallway. So to alleviate those pictures that you've just seen, we are going to show you what the proposed construction project is. So here is a bird's eye site plan of Willard School. In the plan, we have constructed a first floor remodel to add a multi-purpose room. Now, you're gonna see things either parenthetically or actually in the rooms. It doesn't mean that it's final that those things are gonna go there, but this is one efficient way of relocating and distributing these areas that have congestion or space constraints into these areas. So in this area, this multi-purpose room on the first floor, could be a sensory and gross motor skills. We need to alter that existing instructional specialist office and possibly turn it into an occupational therapy, physical therapy, fine motor skills. We would have, by enlarging that, we'll alter the classroom just to the south of it, and that classroom would then get a new cabinetry and some plumbing. Then down the hall where you saw those special ed aides in the foyer, we would be adding some new storage that is desperately needed because some of the storage was behind the instructional specialist. You'll start to get the idea that this is domino effect of anything we are constructing. If we are constructing an existing space and have to move it, we have to find another place to put it. Also, there'll be two new offices created out of one old office, our old occupational therapy area, which this could be special ed therapy area as well as technology support. The second floor addition, just above that. Now, that this is actually an addition. There is nothing there now. It's only a one-story area. That could hold a new STEM lab and a new classroom. Once again, a new classroom, not for additional students, just because if you saw the entire layout of the school, if you started to reconfigure moving that area for basic skills that was in a conference room, if you move then into a full classroom like they need, we'd have to move a certain grade level out of the classroom that is currently occupied in that one into this new classroom. A new multi-purpose room, four new small group instructional spaces which could house the MTSS aide, the tech specialist, the psychologist, and the instructional specialist, which you've all just seen are in various places throughout the building, as well as a new bathroom. Also, the second floor remodel would have an altered existing classroom just like in the floor below to accommodate the hallway and these offices. So we would have to alter that existing classroom, once again getting them new cabinetry and pump. So going back down to the first floor, a more detailed floor plan so you can get the idea. Currently, west is to the top here, east is to the bottom, north is to the right. This is currently two large classrooms with a wall in between them, probably if you looked at this through the word sensory and gross. That wall will be removed to create these smaller classrooms. These are the largest classrooms in the district. No need to be this large. So dropping them by several hundred square feet is not going to make them any smaller than rooms throughout the building. But this is where we could shoehorn in this sensory gross motor, as we talked about. Then moving the instructional specialist out of her office and making it larger, losing some storage, we could put the OT, occupational therapy, physical therapy, fine motor into that area, once again going into that existing classroom, but then giving them some upgrades. Onto the second floor, there's a potential space for a new STEM classroom. And this STEM classroom, the multi-purpose room that you see just to the east of it, and the multi-purpose room below it, because of its special ed, and there could be some medically fragile children in that room, we are going to be air conditioning these three spaces. The air conditioning, just like every other air conditioning improvement we've done in the past 8 years, are all built with the ability to be upgraded for further expansion of air conditioning. There's the new classroom that I talked about earlier, the multi-purpose room. Four new small group instructional spaces, as you can see, who we are proposing they could go to, but it doesn't have to be in that order, even in this area. There will be just four small group instructional spaces. The new bathroom, as well as the remodeled or altered classroom with the hallway. So here are the elevations, very much like what you saw on the colored rendering. But this is if you were standing on Ashland Avenue. So the shaded area is the new addition, second floor. As you can see, there's no change to the footprint. There's no change to the roof line. Where that slope roof comes down, it meets exactly with that. And we'll talk about next week when we present the bid results, what the actual stone coping will look like based on how the bid results did come in. But all the windows are identical. The coins, those little brick, Sven, give me another word, so that's a simile for these coins, these decorative pieces that are at the corner,
yes.
All will match. The brick is the same as what we used back in 97, or at least the closest match that we could find. So this is something that once this is in, probably 6 months, you won't even recognize that it's new. Very much like if you drive by Lincoln today, you can't really even tell that the second floor hasn't been there forever. The height, is only 29.9 above grade, which is well below the 35 feet that the village requires, which is one of the reasons why they approved the amendment last night. Here is if you were standing in the parking lot. From this elevation, you'll see that if you're looking at the addition, it's exact to the first floor. That in the background there is the auditorium. So that is in the distance. All that you're really to be concentrating on is what's here on the left-hand side, these three sets of windows, and that is the only part of the addition, once again showing that it doesn't increase the footprint at all. And then once again, if you were standing on the softball field or on the Franklin side of the building, seeing how it perfectly matches in to the footprint going above the classroom below and above the entranceway on the back side of the school. Once again, the rendering from Ashland. As you can see, where the height of a person is there, or the car, will give you a perspective and or the size of the tree. And that is our presentation. I don't know if there are any questions about the educational impact or any of the other construction-related areas. This is proposed to start the day after school ends, and based on the bids that we just opened today, the low bidder can do it in the time allotted to be done before school starts in August. I'm only going to wait another couple of seconds.
Are there contingency plans we have in case something goes awry?
Well, if we can use 2015 as an example, which was a similar project, I'd say a little larger scale than this one, was one of the wettest summers in recent history. We had some water damage because of the amount of rain and the lack of adequate protection from the contractor, even though it was promised, and there was legal discussions after that to make sure that it was rectified. We were fully prepared in that building to section off an area. This area with the new classroom being on the east, the multi-purpose room in the middle, and then the STEM closest to the stairs there, we could probably say STEM could stay in the library, the multi-purpose room, which is one of the only areas in this plan that doesn't currently have at least more than one thing earmarked for it, and the other classroom, which can stay where it is currently. We could essentially survive how we are right now for several weeks, as long as we have the ability to get up or down that stairwell.
Right.
So we would have to block off that area of construction, but allow for safe passage.
I think the advantage this year of doing this is that there's no new programming going into it. It's all old existing programming, where we could theoretically, as Anthony, we don't want it, but we could theoretically keep things. There's only one person that gets displaced, and that's the person who's right outside the right outside the conference room. And truthfully, we can focus on getting either the first floor done or the second floor done or something like that when we start realizing that we're going to have an issue coming up. So that's kind of a play by ear as we go along in the project, and let's see how much. I mean, as Anthony said, that June of 15, if you remember, there was actually not rain towards the end of the summer. There was an immense amount of rain in June. And that's, of course, when we had the roof open, you know, all the problems because we were putting the structural walls up and everything like that. So hopefully we don't run into that problem. This is also a smaller area, and we don't have any foundation work in this job. The other one we had to put a staircase in, so we're doing some excavation, we're doing some foundation work. And I actually think we started a little bit early too, didn't we? Let them start digging a little bit before the summer began.
I try to block out all these old projects once they're done. So, my own sanity. I don't remember exactly, but you know there was.
But in all
this, that seemed to be more substantial.
I didn't get in answer to the questions from the contractors during bidding. I didn't get any questions about timing. In the 2015 one, they were all concerned about timing. This one's a lot easier because we've knocked out some of the initial trades. So.
Yes.
Is there some summer school programming that happens at
Woodward? The summer school is always at Woodward, always. Our plan is for summer school to be at Roosevelt, and then the K-4 building, it alternates. Summer of 18, it's at Lincoln. That's what our plan is.
And just to clarify some of the air conditioning, I know the district has been talking about it for a long time. Most of the people in the audience are board members. Every unit ventilator we put, so there's three spaces that are going to get air conditioning in this one. And we've got small little, almost, they're not residential, but they're similar to residential. They're going to go in the bushes if you go back to the elevation. Because we've got a play field on one side with a walking area on that side. We've got a parking lot on the other side. Really, the best place to put them is in the front of the building. And we got bushes, so we're going to be putting them behind the bushes. But the units are, you know, 30 inches by 30 inches, and there's going to be three of them. So those locations will be kind of where the unit is. But every other room that we're putting in has what's called a unit ventilator, which is a piping system. And we're making these all ready for air conditioning down the line, so that if ever the district decides to go ahead and do it, we can just slot a coil into these units, have it, you know, have a cooling coil in there, and then we can break it up. So.
Yeah, and that's consistent with what we've done for
months. That's right. For the past, since we did the last life safety program.
2010.
How far in the future do you think that we will be able to air condition both Lincoln and Miller?
Well, the dollar amounts that we've talked about don't change. I shouldn't say they don't change. They will change with inflation. This project doesn't change the trajectory of that. As we said, we've been doing this type of preparation for upgrades, and that's been built into any other financial projection you've seen. So this is no different than that. So we can go back to the estimates, back to what we talked about. That doesn't change what we've
talked about. I thought those estimates, when we talked about $3 million, that was for like retrofitting of the school. I'm asking about just fully air conditioning these new spaces here, the new rooms that we're adding.
Well, okay. Well, we're adding the three on the second floor, two of them will be air conditioned.
Okay.
And
STEM
and the multipurpose. And then the new one, essentially, we're putting on the first floor, which has some special ed and medically fragile students. We're air conditioning that. The classrooms that are existing that aren't air conditioned will remain on air conditioned.
Okay,
that's
it. Does the first floor have bathrooms?
The first floor what?
The first floor, the area that's going to be remodeled, have a bathroom right below the bathroom.
No, because that would be in the exit way. But there's a bathroom about 30 feet south of that.
Yeah.
And that's a handicap bathroom there as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, this bathroom that we're doing is not a handicap bathroom, it's just a community bathroom. So there's a lot of offices right there. So
yeah.
That putting a single, you know, private bathroom in there.
There was no requirement to put a bathroom here, but we felt it was a good improvement. It's a single one, not a gang bathroom or a handicap bathroom. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Andy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf.
Well, before we move on to the next item, if it's all right, Ralph, the design for this is really thoughtfully constructed, and I think there are three parties or individuals who deserve credit for getting us to this point. You know, Diane Wood and her faculty really put a lot of thought into what their needs versus wants were. Of course, we want all the things in the world for our students and staff, but we realize that's not always reasonable. And so the time and energy, I know she and her staff put into thinking about how this space could be optimally configured is really valuable in terms of being a product. Certainly Sven being creative and trying to fit all of those items into the envelope space that we had is certainly very instrumental in this. And then Anthony's help in trying to make sure that it remained cost effective is really important too. So we're very pleased, I think, with the kind of dynamics of this project. We hope that it, you know, meets the board's expectations in terms of what we intended, anticipated in the beginning. We think it's going to really, I would not want to speak for you, Diane, but I think in this case, we think it will really change the dynamics within the building and optimize the learning environment for all of our students, and hopefully do it in a pretty cost-effective way. We realize it's a significant expenditure, but we think we're getting a great deal of value for the expenditure.
And I will say, getting back to the contingency plan, it's really Sven and my job, as well as the job of the general contractor, to yell at all the workers when it's getting close. And we've, knock on wood, never had that issue where they've gone past their deadline.
I know you don't have the information now, but the anticipated low bidder is somebody we've worked with many, many years. I mean, put it this way, I'm third generation. My grandfather worked with their company. So they've been around for a long time. They've done work in this district. When crisis came in with a low budget as well.
Okay.
So.
And we'll talk about those next Tuesday.
Thank you.
think you have another one.
Thank you. It's a fun project.
Oh, I'm sorry. There's one last thing. I'm sorry. We are scheduled to talk at some point in time, either this later this month or next month, with the River Forest Historical Commission. So, because this is a historical landmark in River Forest. So that is really the last piece. They can give recommendations, but they don't have any authority over what we can do.
Did anybody come up with the Cindy for coins?
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank Thanks.
You. Thanks.
Hey, you too. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the Education Committee, right?
Yes. Yes, I think Dr. Hawk, she's doing the presentation.
Jump right in.
Yeah, I think I'm going to jump right in.
Okay. Great. So it's a real pleasure to obviously introduce people.
Did you buy some time? I'll figure out.
Yes, absolutely. Well,
I didn't
to introduce
you.
The people that you know well.
Yes.
Who have a.
I think we need to give it out to some professional.
Exactly. Yeah. So before actually they begin their presentation tonight, our board members will notice that they received their complimentary copies of The End of Average. This is a book that we wanted to share with our board members. We know how busy they are and how much reading we give them to do, but it's by Todd Rose, and several of our faculty members will recognize it. It's a book that our Universal Design for Learning committee is actually reading, and it's been, I think, really seminal for them because, while it's a highly accessible book and it draws lots of examples from different fields and experiences to illustrate the point, it has helped spur some really important conversation about the importance of considering individual differences to ensure success. And everything from examples of fighter pilots needing to have cockpits that can be individually configured to the difference between someone ordering their ice cream at Baskin Robbins with 31 flavors or going and getting their frozen yogurt where they can make their own. A lot of really great kind of real life examples, but for our faculty, it spurred some nice conversations about how it's important in this day and age to acknowledge that we cannot treat individuals on the basis of the average and expect that not only are we not going to meet most of their needs, but that realistically we won't meet anyone's needs. And so to rethink those systems that we have, like the public schools, where they're predicated on the idea of providing to the average. Our board members, of course, have heard so much about the Universal Design for Learning concept and framework that it will be no short jump for them in understanding how important that concept will be as we're implementing the Universal Design for Learning framework with validity and fidelity moving forward. So wanted you to have that. Is it working?
No.
Okay. Do you want to do an airplane?
Give me 1 minute to make a phone call.
So I need an airplane code, and usually the code shows up somewhere.
That's not the AirPlay screen, so I don't know if that. I don't know. Sorry, I wish I knew, but I need professional development too.
Just talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah, right.
Thank you.
See, there's the goose, which is real.
To me, that would not be a major issue. So, is he the
first one? Don't believe that. Funny.
Yes.
We're very close to Low Town.
So, we are very fortunate tonight to have some of our teacher leaders and instructional leaders to speak a little bit with the community about our literacy committee work. We're fortunate to have, of course, Dr. Hawley and Louisa Starr is with us tonight, Kathleen Fleming, Pam Moriarty, and Jennifer Ankerberg. You probably know three of the four of those folks as our instructional specialists, and the infamous Louisa Starr, representing the Humanities Department here at Roosevelt. So we're glad to have them here. Thanks for your patience.
Okay, thank you. Apologies for the tech glitch. Normally it just comes up. Today it didn't. So yes, as Dr. Khan just mentioned, I am very fortunate to have members of our literacy committee join us today. We just introduced, and they will be presenting here shortly. We're going to give you a brief update on our progress towards our goals for the literacy committee. Up to this point. This work is a little bit different from the math leadership team in that when we did the math leadership team, we met monthly for full release days or half release days, whereas now we have monthly meetings for an hour and a half at a time. So the work is moving along nicely, but at a slightly different pace than the math leadership team work did. However, it's following the exact same process. So while we have four fantastic volunteers to help share progress today, we wanted to make sure that you see a full list of all the members we have on the committee. We have two slides worth, actually. That's how many people are on it, which is nice to see. As always, we are looking for representation across buildings, representation across grades, and also representation across professional roles to make sure that we can have the most informed, rich conversation that possible. So, I think something else that is also helpful to note is this group did start out as a K-4 writing committee, but as we got towards the end of last year, we decided it was really important to look at the span of literacy, not just writing, across K-8. Since we look at reading and writing as reciprocal processes, it's really important to make sure that the thoughtful process that went behind writing also goes into reading, so we go through best practices research and make sure confirm the decisions we've currently made and or look for opportunities where we can expand the instructional practices that we've already implemented in the last couple of years. That essentially is the work of the committee, but our representatives tonight will give you a little more detail in terms of where we are. So first off, Jennifer.
So the team has undertaken several worthy goals.
Can you close that?
Of course.
Don't buy it.
Right, it's on me. Don't buy it. Sorry.
We're working hard to solidify some comprehensive goals across grade levels so that we have student goals.
what D90 readers and writers will look like. We're also working hard to deepen the understanding we have of all the different areas of literacy, from phonics to comprehension and fluency and all of the aspects across grade levels as well. With all those things backing us up, we're creating and crafting a vision statement for what balanced literacy will look like in our district. And that will, when that's in place, we'll be able to use that to guide us as we select instructional materials, resources, other things that will help us achieve that vision for all of our learners. And as we work together and we meet with people from other buildings and find out what each other are doing in those buildings to strengthen literacy practices, we'll be able to identify more areas where we can collaborate and connect our efforts. So, pass it off to our next speaker.
I love these. We don't get them in the classroom, so thank you, Anthony. Okay, so we have some pretty simple goals, but we think they're really important. Their overarching goals of our committee are we want to teach kids across the grade levels and among all of the institutions in our district to communicate clearly and directly with an eye to what their audience needs and how to make their point clear. We want them to read strategically and be critical thinkers, which of course means something different when they're reading literature than it does when they're reading a nonfiction book. But we don't just want them to believe that everything that they read is automatically true. We want them to challenge what they see and what they hear, and we want them to develop standards for developing a way to assess what's true and what isn't. I think that's one of the most fundamental and important skills that we can offer to them. So we want them to be able to think flexibly and feel confident in their ability to both evaluate the way an author has used evidence and gather evidence themselves as writers and use it. And perhaps the most important goal of our committee is we want these kids to see themselves as lovers of reading and writing, and we want them to feel that this is something that they're starting here with, that they're going to continue for the rest of their lives.
So this past summer, we started with a subgroup of our literacy committee, and there were representatives from all the grade levels, and we worked together and we to build a framework that everything else is going to be based on. So what we're going to be showing you is a draft of that work. It's in no way complete. But this work has enabled us to have a lot of deep professional conversations and really get to know each other and to look for alignment and to see what is really the same in kindergarten and eighth grade, to look for those commonalities and to see how the kids grow and as from a kindergartner to an eighth grader. So we've spent a lot of time doing that. We model this, our framework, after the UDL, which you're going to read more about in your book. And we're all starting to learn that. So we are in no way saying that we're experts, but we are expert learners in this goal. And it's a journey that has really been very rewarding because we're getting to know what's going on in every grade and get to know, have those professional conversations that are really amazing. And to see, find out what is really good in our district, which there is so much, but what things we can make even better.
Oh, sure.
So one part that these frameworks really help with is the visibility of the learning goals. And when we say visibility, we mean to teachers, community members, and then also teachers as well. And the frameworks are set up in a really understandable way for different audiences. And they can certainly be revised for different audiences. The other piece that's so important is having that consistency and alignment across content areas and across grade levels. And so this, in literacy, you know, we look at writing, for example, as a place that we've started, yet we'll also look to that consistency alignment across all areas of literacy once all of the different frameworks are completed. Which lastly helps us to facilitate horizontal and vertical alignment across grade levels. So across bands, but then also, you know, K-8. So this next slide is an example of one of the drafts for the writing framework. And again, the ultimate goal will be that there'll be frameworks for literacy, for example. And so this one is for information writing for third grade. And on the left-hand side, you've got the writing standards that would be addressed in the information writing for the year for third grade. And at the top, what we want students to be able to do, and ultimately looking at what we want students to know, understand, and be able to do, broken into these four different categories of understandings, essential questions, and the essential questions, that work is so critical. And Pam talked about the collaborative conversations that grade levels are having, and those conversations are always already starting, because an essential question is not one that necessarily has one definitive answer. It's typically an open-ended question, and a question that can have multiple answers. And so when we look at this, these essential questions, they're critical to student learning, and they, the crafting of them is difficult, and yet so important.
Another aspect, and I've touched upon this, I think, at other communications with or whether it was at retreats or committee updates or an education meeting, is we're looking closely at our resources, not just instructional materials that teachers will use as professionals, but also taking a look at the offerings that we have in our classrooms. So taking a close look at our classroom libraries is something that we started to do. We feel is really important. It certainly ties into our Universal Design for Learning initiative as well. We're looking at diversity of choice, diversity of protagonists. We want to make sure we've got a range of books for student interests. And essentially, we really want to make sure that students see themselves in the literature that they read. It's really the concept of windows and mirrors, is that they can pick up a book and they can mirror who they are in their experience, which is very validating for students, but also acts as a window and they can look in out onto experiences that other people have. I think, you know, having a more diverse book selection creates more diverse, inclusive conversations and more diverse, inclusive classrooms. So we started this work. Thankfully, you know, our partnership with Teachers College Reading and Writing from Columbia University in New York City has done the lion's share of this work, in the sense that they curated all these books. So they spent summers where they had books up to the ceiling in their basement where they read through them. They weeded through books that had racial and gender stereotypes and weeded them out of the collection. They made sure that they have a range of levels, so accessibility is a major piece or a major driving force for having a library that can meet the needs of all of our students. So we started identifying those classroom libraries for different grade levels, and we're going to continue to build those. They are not inexpensive, so we're going to be fiscally responsible. We did a first round of ordering, making sure we have clear ways to incorporate these books into the classroom before we continue on and learn more. It will be a multi-year effort. The one challenge with this is just that teachers inherit books over time, and while we're incorporating new books with their inventory, we have lists, so we know exactly what we have just ordered. What we need to do is now purge all the stuff that we no longer need. So there are grade levels that have 5-4 curriculum hours, and they are working in 4-6 hour increments when they are together as teams going through their collections. The instructional specialists and I have pulled resources that have pretty clear rubrics that they can use to go through to help lead through their collections. Something more than 10 years old is, again, gender and racial stereotypes, things like that that we want to make sure. If there are books that the kids never pick up off the shelf and don't read, it's taking space of a book that kids would, so we want to make sure we're purging. However, that takes space. So while we're in initial phases right now, I think our biggest purge is probably going to happen in the summer. It's pretty messy work when you take everything off your shelves and you need to go with it and put stuff back. So we are moving, and we're looking forward to continue to build our collections and support the range of learners in our classrooms. And finally, we're pretty proud of where we are right now. I think putting together the entire span of K-8 teachers, we've been speaking to our goals in vertical groups, meaning we have kindergarten, first, second, through eighth, sitting at a single table, so they're getting to know each other, they're getting more familiar with the entire span of literacy and reading life that kids experience when they're here. The whole goal is to make sure that we go through this process, we're looking through the eyes of the student. What is their journey? What is their trajectory look like? And norming ourselves around best practices. So we've done a lot of reading, a lot of discussion, and we now feel like we're in a position where we can start to draft our balanced literacy statement. So that's what we're going to do in our next meeting, which also coincides right after when our consultant will be here from Teachers College. So it's nice that she can land and give suggestions. Certainly, once, as Jennifer mentioned, once we have our vision in place, it will help us evaluate our classroom resources, and should we decide that we need to go in a different direction or supplements, we will certainly bring that to the board for your approval. And then certainly the template that we shared with you, we've drafted for each grade level, there's a narrative, an information, and an opinion unit. We've drafted three units for grades K through six. One grade may have a couple still in process. So the goal is to refine those over the summer and expand them for the rest of the grade levels. And that's where we are right now. And we'll have updated goals and measures later in the year and with some recommendations for the board sometime in the spring.
Allison, what will we do with the materials that we decide that are no longer workable for us? Will we donate those?
I think we can donate them. There's...
I think there are many other places where they would be most welcome.
And I've had conversations at one of our last, probably last spring, with a Green for Good member who was saying that she'd be happy to help us, because she, I think, regularly works through.
I know there are other city schools that have nothing.
Yes, I don't. We certainly want to make sure that they can be used somewhere else. They should.
My standard question on this is, how does grammar?
At dinner, we were talking about who's going to ask the grammar question. We thought it would be Rich, but so grammar.
Ralph makes a split infinitives.
I'm glad Louisa decided what the Toro genre was. There was one before the thing. So okay, the language and speaking standards are also incorporated into those maps. However, so they're embedded in the units and they are present. But we also talked about we want them needed a single document that really does articulate and span on all of those things, so it actually will become a supplementary document to the individual units. So that tends to come later in the work, so the work is here, the units and standards for this particular scope and sequence, but those are going to require some best practices and discussions. We are all over the map right now in terms of what research says about how grammar instruction should be conducted, and
but there will be a comprehensive approach providing instruction properly.
Yes, and that will require some education and communication, I think, with multiple stakeholders. There is, I think many of us experienced a what I would call a traditional grammar instruction experience growing up, and best practices does not always mirror that. So we have some work to do in terms of communicating and laying that out. But it's necessary because it's always the first question that comes up.
How does this affect classic books that are in the curriculum? So, or in the classroom, are there usually classics like First Time, Wrinkle of Time, Little Women? Do teachers hold those in their classrooms? And
that's also a conversation we're having with literacy pages. What is the balance between contemporary and classical literature, and how do you choose? And to what degree do you give kids access for free reading classics, and then what do you determine that you teach? And grade levels will make those decisions. So really the literacy committee will talk about when we do our vision of balanced literacy, what does it mean to be balanced? That relates to what kids are reading, how they're reading them. Are they reading them in book groups? Are they reading them in a whole group? Are they doing an interactive read aloud? So those are decisions that will come down the line when we get to resources. But
also, what's considered a classic?
And that's a whole rabbit hole we could go down. But, what is classic and what is not, and what really is. You know. So the classics tend to endure over time, and I think, again, it's really about balance. There's a lot of good contemporary literature that really embraces student issues that they care about in really sophisticated ways, but then there are classics that really test the time, and we want sure that there's a sort of a literary canon that kids are supposed to read. So, as far as
when you mentioned literary canon, I know that there is occasional redundancy with what we teach here and what Old Hartford or Forest teaches. And as we're evaluating all of this, it would be good to consult that integration so that we do it as effectively as we can, because I know that kids have read the Iliad or the Odyssey with us and then gone to the high school and read it again. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, but I do think that we should make sure that if we are doing this kind of an overhaul, we look carefully at what will be expected of them as they go over there and make sure that we are putting all of those pieces together so that we provide them with the best possible background.
If
I could just speak to that, I was just going to say, just to reassure you a little bit, they don't read the Iliad in both places, they just read it here. They read the Odyssey in both places, but they read a kiddie version of the Odyssey as fifth graders, and they read the sort of literal translation of it when they get to high school, so it's really a very different book. But I do agree with you, Mark, that we need to interface with.
Well, and I think To Kill a Mockingbird has been
absolutely, and there's some other ones.
And that is one of my top five favorite books.
There are
also
great. I agree with you that that question needs to be asked. I just wanted to clarify about the Odyssey itself, because the version they read is highly abridged. It's a child's version when they read it here in fifth grade.
Yeah. And they actually may not be using it anymore. So, We want to make sure we review. There's some, especially in middle school, and I don't particularly think this is really, they do have, what's your term for books that you don't like, read your sacred books? Is that the term you use?
There's a sheltered book list, but the high school traditionally has kind of done its own thing, and so it would be very helpful. I agree with Barbara, it would be helpful to have an interfacing mechanism with them. That would be great.
There's so many layers that go with this when you look at all the things that literacy can be to children. So, to be continued.
How can you summer school as a resource for this program as well?
Well, one of the things Karen and I and Katie Collins, who is our summer school principal, sat together and talked about when we look at interventions and different programs that are happening, now that we have foundational materials during the school year, how can we move those into the summer school program so there's consistency throughout the year? So we do have the materials. One of the things we just have to figure out how all the pieces fit together. What there are for the materials that we've adopted, there are, especially for writing, there are parallel intervention programs so for a writer's workshop that exists. So we have those materials, so for interventions we can use those. So the interventions are seamless with what the instruction looks like during the school year, so it doesn't look like a one-off or it's not connected to what we're doing. So we're looking at that now.
Awesome. How does this connect with how the children are being assessed over the course of the year? It's like part of a map testing. What's the impact it will have?
The closer the assessment is to the classroom is really how you can see where the impact of your instruction is. The MAP and the AIMS web is sort of higher level in terms of overall achievement and where students are at that point in time with their achievements. So what we have with these new resources is we've got the Fondestimpanel benchmarking, which we've got expectations that go across the year that sort of span children's growth. So we can look at classroom-based assessments to check our growth against that. We want to make sure that we are looking at multiple sources of data to get a full picture of students. So, the higher level MAP assessments, AIMS that we have at the classroom, Fondestimpanel is one. There are rubrics that are established that go with the units that we're doing. So there's a direct correlation between the instruction that's being delivered in the classroom and the assessments that are being utilized. So we want to make sure that there's alignment there, so we know exactly what we're assessing. So when we look at that big picture, we get a sense of where students are. So
when we think about it, though, from a community perspective, the thing that we get evaluated on as a district is how did the kids do on the power test. That's the thing that the board gets letters about.
Right.
So when they hear about changes in
math and literacy, and we're talking about UDL over time, what the community will look at was how are our kids doing on park testing after all of these changes that we're making.
I would say the biggest thing that is probably helpful to us is a lot of the resource selections we're doing is an exercise in alignment. So the fact that we have common materials that are tied to the grade level standards, which is what the park is tied to, these materials were researched and created with the standards in mind, and they've been pilot tested, and they've been very thoughtfully put together in terms of their progression. So I would certainly hope that we would continue to see the stellar reading results that we have. There's always room for growth.
Do you think you'll see changes? Because one thing we've seen is as the kids get older, which I'm sure all of us see in our own homes, is less interest in reading and literacy. I mean, do you think this will address some of that later middle school drop off in attention and interest?
I think there's several factors that probably play into that. I think kids as they get older, they have less time. And I think when they have less time to read outside of school, which is where a lot of our reading is currently happening. I mean, there's obviously a reading in school, but the independent reading kind of falls off. I think the discussion we're having at the literacy committee, I'm not into dumbing all these answers, so if you want to grab the mic, please feel free. The role of voice and choice is very, very important. If kids find a book that they love and they want to pull off the shelf, they will read it. If they are given a book that they're not interested in, they don't want to read, they will take it. So, it really is part of the conversation is how to broaden our reading choices enough that there are some things we might believe kids have to read, but what's the goal? And I think the overarching goal that we put together is really important because what's really driving us? We want kids to love to read. So to continually put books in their hands that they don't like is not going to help them love to read. So the overarching goals, I think, need to be a guidepost for us in best practice. So.
And Allison, any aspects of the UDL, right?
Absolutely.
Are designed specifically to get the student more engaged in their own learning and hopefully.
Choice. Student choice.
Right. It translates to what they're reading and getting them to read more. And a lot of the underlying elements of the UDL are predicated on the project based learning that's developed over time. And project based learning has been very effective in helping kids perform well. So as long as we do a really good job of understanding what the standards are, what we're set up with materials, et cetera, the changes in approach to instruction, pedagogy, and the concepts underlying the UDL should actually help Team 90 students perform better over time under the standard.
I would echo that, and it's the expansion of choice and ownership and student agency. I'm not sure that ended up as an overarching goal, but student independence and student agency is really key, and that does go with voice and choice. And those are the things when our students walk out of here and they go over to NPRF or wherever else they go outside of District 90, we want to make sure that they have that sense of empowerment, that they can connect to their interests, formulate important questions, and find evidence to back up their claims.
The resource their smartphones. But we're not allowed to do that, are we?
Okay, yes. Yes, thank you. Catherine just brought up that one of the things we are looking at is motivation and engagement and what best practices say about that. So that's certainly going to be woven into our decision making. There are many layers. We're looking forward to peeling them all back as soon as we have our vision set. I think we'll be ready to lay out the rest of our action planning for at least the next couple of years.
You said in your next steps that you're looking forward to balance the literacy statement. Is there how far along are we?
We're
20 English based teachers in one room trying to wordsmith something. I'm sure it's going to be great.
No, I think we're in a really good spot. Balanced literacy is actually already defined. So part of it was helping bring that to the forefront for everybody. And one of the last exercises we did is we had people do some writing about, do you recall what the prompt was? I don't remember. All right, well, we did some pre-writing. And essentially, the result from that is we're going to take, if we were to put together a framework, what were the important components that you feel that should be in it? And essentially, when we laid out all the responses, it essentially was a balanced literacy framework, which is great.
Well,
I think that's important to have that statement, that overarching statement about all the great work and that everybody's doing, the community wants to know.
Yeah, we hope to have it for you. I would imagine sometime in the spring. I think we have another, we may have one more update scheduled for you. We should have it by then. I would say it's probably just based on our last free write that we did, it's probably 50% drafted. It just needs to be finessed. So we're moving along. That's good.
Thank you for your work on this.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. And thank you to Lisa, Kathleen, and
all right, so with the board's permission, we do have just two other items tonight, and the first deals with the strategic plan. I don't know if board members would wish to or want to look at their packet to review that. If not, we can kind of do it more off the cuff. And then the second deals with math and math acceleration. So as far as the first, we really kind of historically had a routine of making sure that we come back to the board couple or several times a year to kind of ensure the board that there's been ongoing progress and that the focus continues to be where it should be with the strategic plan. So those are the documents that the board members received tonight in their packet. Some of them look very familiar, probably ad nauseum, the overview of the strategic plan as well as the specific action objectives for the forthcoming year. What's new to the board, and I'm sure they had a chance to see this in the packets earlier, is the assignment of individuals to the action objective teams. Those have all been configured. And as a matter of fact, I know a couple of them have already met. Others I know are scheduled to meet this month. But those action objective teams, as you probably recall, they do change from year to year, but they're comprised of faculty, staff members, parents, and administrators. And their role, for those of you who aren't as familiar with the strategic planning process, is really to provide oversight to make sure that the work that needs to be done to ensure that those action objectives are being completed is being done. The action objectives themselves that were determined for the forthcoming year and discussed by the Board of Ed at the Board Retreat last summer and then implemented this fall with the administrative team are varied. Obviously, they all touch in some way one of the five major goals that were identified by the stakeholders in the community. The strategic plan was created in the first place. But they're at varying places, and some of them are significant multi-year goals that you would not be able to accomplish probably fully in less than a couple of years. Others of them are quick hit things, such as the learning environment goal from last year and the reconfiguration of a couple of pilot classrooms with new furniture and seat configurations. The update, I know that the Resources Committee has already done this year on the resident-friendly financial reporting document. So, you know, they vary in terms of the types of time they're coming to. But importantly, board members will also see in the packet the entities to which those specific goals have been assigned. So the action objective teams, again, their role is oversight. The actual work is being done by those assigned committees, or in some cases, their ad hoc groups, in some cases, their pre-existing groups like the Superintendent's Leadership Council. As much as anything, again, kind of to bring that back, the goal is just to make sure that our board is aware that the work is ongoing, that, you know, it seems to be on the rails at this point for where we are in the year. A much more formal and comprehensive update also in the past that we provided with the Superintendent's Leadership Council in June. But the wheel keeps turning, which is kind of the design of that 5 years. Well, is ongoing, but it's on his back, and that frankly it's never really done. You know, we're all about continuous improvement. There should be very few things that we're actually checking off the list. There are a few of those things, but largely it's making sure that we have the systems in place that ongoing improvements are taking place. So just wanted to bring that forward. Was there anything from the packet that the board members wanted to ask about? I would please to comment as well.
I just would like to comment that, you know, with all of our goals in the strategic plan and all the strategies that we've developed, there's so much work going on and so much effective activity toward, you know, effective education for our kids. The community can ask, you know, how we're getting things done. And over the past 3 years as a board member, these presentations are so informative. So I for the record, would say to the community, please review some of our past Cal presentations, because they just give us a lot of insight. So then I was looking again at strategy 8. So I'd like to say that because we go on forever about how much great work is going on. And then strategy 8, family partnerships among resources, going back, connecting this to tonight's presentation, what can the committee do to advise parents at home to work with their kids? So an example would be second grade running records, and go home and we would, I'd sit with the kids, and my wife would sit with the kids, and we would actually have an activity that the teachers told us we must do. So having some homework with our kids versus just, you know, it's a good idea to go home and read with your kids for a half an hour, 2 minutes, you know, those kinds of things. So I would ask that the committee maybe add something to resources and family partnerships in terms of literacy.
I think it makes a whole lot of sense for us to make sure that we're using a more expansive definition of that. In terms of the outreach to families, we have this new website, of course, that was just launched this year, and Dawn and Kevin and several other people in the district have really been working hard to make sure that the structure is there. But I know the vision for that is that that could become, obviously, a much more robust portal for families, particularly to access that kind of information. We talked, for folks who were aware a little bit last summer about the opportunities that might be available with this more robust platform to make things like videos for families available or additional spotlight articles about initiatives that have gone on, things we haven't really been able to do because some of the limitations of that, frankly. So,
not asking for more homework, but saying
no more. Absolutely. So, thank you for that. Certainly more. Questions about that? Okay. If not, then the last item we had to present was really about math, fourth grade math. And, we're prepared to answer any questions really that the board may have. Again, we provided some background information for the board and their packet on this. But we, Allison and I just wanted to, make sure that we were kind of circling back on discussion that board members had as well, specific to math and the accelerated math program in fourth grade. That is under review. The board had asked that we take a close look at whether or not we're accomplishing our intended goals with the acceleration model that's currently in place. Board members will also remember one of the other elements that kind of moved along with this was recommendation from through the strategic planning process from the Action Objective team to rethink the administration of the CODAC assessment. Our community, I think largely, and certainly our board members and administrators and teachers as well, are always concerned about the amount of assessment we do. We felt like that was one assessment we might be able to walk back. But if you walk back, you've got to think about why we were administering that in the first place. And some of it was to identify the requisite skills and abilities that students would need to be able to demonstrate to qualify for accelerated programming. And really, the main accelerated program we have in our K-4s right now, of course, is that fourth grade accelerated program. So, again, as much as anything, we want to make sure that we're reporting back to the board and keeping them updated on the progress there. Very likely, because we want to make sure that if we are potentially coming forward to the board in the future with a recommendation to configure that accelerated math program, that we want to do that responsibly and make sure that if that happens, we can assure families and the community that students who in the past have qualified for that would be exposed to the requisite rigor they would need in a whole group instructional model. We aren't ready to come forward with anything probably this spring. We do intend to administer the COGAT again this spring, which again has been done for many years. So we do have that data on hand. We know it will be helpful for placement purposes, knowing that this math accelerated model will continue for the upcoming year. But if the administration, based upon the recommendations from the teachers and our findings and how we could provide that same rigorous instruction model were to allow us to make that recommendation to the board, it would very likely happen sometime next fall. With the intention being that that would provide more than adequate time for us to engage stakeholder groups, parents, faculty, administrators, and figure out what it would look like for us to transition off that current model. Again, how we could assure families that children would be exposed to a very high level of rigorous instruction, the whole group model instead of the current pull-out approach, and that teachers felt confident that they were able to meet those children's needs in their whole classroom. So I know I'm kind of talking ambiguously about this, so I guess what we're sharing is that we're not certainly prepared to make a recommendation anytime in the near future on this. It is still under review. A math leadership team, of course, is putting a close eye to it. Elementary principals, I know, have been doing some investigation of best practices. But we do intend, unless the board would direct otherwise, that as we have in the past, we would be administering the PUG again in spring and hoping to bring you some type of definitive recommendation on our suggestion about the future of the accelerated math sometimes.
And I would just say that in this community, it's crucial that families are fully informed that students that do require more challenging math are going to get it. And I think explaining the research behind the new approach will be very important.
Okay.
And I think you probably should dedicate a town hall forum to it. Once you have settled on a recommendation, it's been vetted in the work. I really think that that's crucial to move forward the program in this area.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what we absolutely have to bring forward is overarching goals for our kids.
Yep.
What are the measures that are connected to those goals so we can ensure that we are meeting those goals? And we do, I'm calling through the research base right now, and stuff is starting to come together, but it's one thing I think that we is critical to us, and the difficulty is it doesn't exist, which is the challenge, is the COGAT is an assessment that doesn't really align with the skill sets we're looking for accelerated math. So our concern is that it is not evaluating, it's misidentifying children.
It becomes an equity issue as well, because it selects out kids that are capable of doing it, because if they're showing they're doing it in the classroom and this one test at this one time says they can't do it, then they don't get access.
That's our concern. So what is the measurement that will ensure that kids really do have the concepts that they need to continue on? And I want to make sure we outline the Common Core challenges really clearly as well, because our current model will zip kids through 4 years of math in 2 years. And for some kids, they could do that. However, if we over-accelerate kids, it shows up on the back end when they get to calculus and they get to higher math. So again, it's about what is the goal. Is the goal for them to view math as something that is doable and relevant and important, or is it a tool for admissions to college and then they drop out of, what are the goals? You need to be very clear about that. And then finding the right assessments that will ensure that kids have mastered what they need to master. We don't want to hold any child back. We want to make sure that it is appropriately challenged. Our concern at the moment is we're not the appropriate tool.
Yeah, and you may find that what you need is more than one.
Oh, sure. Sure, any single data point is probably, and I will say we are not the only school district that is struggling with those sort of things. How do you identify kids for accelerated math? There's a lot of community pressure. There are a lot of conceptions around math as being a gateway to a higher intellectual experience, and research doesn't really flesh that out anymore. So communication is a big piece, aligning with OPRF is a big piece. They're talking about math and equity as well. So is District 97 at our last articulation meeting. Setting that together as a tri-district group, to what degree can we stand shoulder to shoulder on issues of equity so we can educate the entire community and not just one pocket. So we're smaller, and because we're smaller, we can move faster. So we'll have to figure out how to continue this articulation. But I don't know, it's pretty exciting, at least from my curriculum office perspective. So. But there is a lot of legwork to do. It's got to be tight, because this is something that will bring people out to the town hall.
a low cost.
Not a doubt.
All right, other questions about that? Okay.
So I'm looking for the most important motion.
All in favor?
Yeah.